I enjoy a nice glass of wine, but I don't pretend to be an expert in wine. I usually just want a wine that's high quality, delicious, and not too expensive. And to me, that's Bogle Family Vineyards. And here's the thing about Bogle. This is a third generation family-owned winery from California that makes exceptional wines for about 10 bucks a bottle. Bogle wines consistently earn Best Buy designations and high ratings from wine enthusiasts. And let me tell you something. The folks at Wine Enthusiast, they drink a lot of wine. They drink a lot of fancy, expensive wine. And yet they still keep giving great ratings to Bogle. And Bogle Vineyards has so many different kinds of wine. Whatever your mood, whatever you're eating, there's a wine for you. They got this great Pinot Grigio that's crisp and fruity, goes well with spicy foods, with fish. They have a classic Chardonnay that's balanced, amazing with a pork tenderloin or butter chicken. I like to take that Chardonnay and do what Jacques Pepin taught me, a couple of ice cubes in your glass of Bogle. If Jacques Pepin says it's okay, then it's okay. And there's the Bogle Pinot Noir, refined and elegant with bright fruit and about as food-friendly as a red wine can be. You're not going to believe it's only $10. Neither will your friends if you tell them. So pick up a few bottles of Bogle wherever you buy your favorite wines. Please drink responsibly. Previously on Anything's Possible.
The 20th century is when Italians start eating pasta regularly, and...
Wait, you're telling me that pasta wasn't a big thing in Italy until the 1900s?
That's right.
Spaghetti alla Sassina, that's tasty, it's crunchy, and you can never stop eating it. It's a lot of people, even in Italy, don't know about it. People must know about it.
Like, you're putting all this work in, and then, like, what if the book, you know, doesn't sell? You are a great storyteller, and you're a great writer, but, like, you even say you're not a chef.
This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. And this is episode 3 of Anything's Possible, a 4-part series giving you the inside story of the making of my first cookbook. By the end, you'll never look at a cookbook the same way again. If you haven't listened to parts 1 and 2 yet, please go back and start there. And hey, before we get into it, I do want to mention that throughout this series, I'm sharing photos and videos of the whole process on my Instagram. I even posted a video of the scene in the kitchen at Al Sorso Preferito in Bari with everyone arguing over how to make spaghetti alla Sassina. It's pretty priceless. So check all that out and follow me on Instagram at TheSporkful. All right, let's do this. When I set out to write my cookbook, my pasta fairy godmother, Evan Kleiman, warned me. She said Americans writing about Italian food often get caught up in the romance and nostalgia of Italy. They end up rehashing the same old traditional recipes with the same photos of the hills of Tuscany and nonas and aprons caked in flour. I returned from Italy more determined than ever to avoid these tropes. Because my biggest takeaway from the trip is that the romance around Italian food is tied up in a lot of mythology. Pasta culture isn't as old or as static as I thought. It may not evolve as fast as some cuisines, but like all the others, it's always changing. Now I see my book as part of this never-ending evolution of pasta. In the fall of 2022, I head back into my kitchen. To meet my publisher's deadline, I have to finish all my recipes in 6 months. The list of recipes I want to include is almost full, and my team of developers has been hard at work on them. But there are a few that I want to try to do on my own. At the start of this process, I wouldn't have considered attempting that. But now I've tested a few dozen recipes for my developers, and I feel like I'm getting the hang of this. I want to see if I can do it, if I can take some of these recipes from start to finish myself. The first dish I'm going to try is not an original creation. It's my spin on one of the dishes I went to Italy to learn about. All right, so I am 15 minutes into my first attempt to make spaghetti alla Sassina from scratch. As you'll recall from episode 2, spaghetti alla Sassina, or Assassin's Spaghetti, is the dish from the city of Bari that I fell in love with. The spaghetti is pan-fried in a spicy tomato sauce until the sauce is sticky and the pasta is charred and crispy crunchy. Now, as we heard, there's a big debate in Bari about whether to boil the pasta briefly before pan-frying it. At Giotto, the restaurant that served my favorite version, they don't boil. They put uncooked, dry pasta straight into a frying pan filled with spicy tomato sauce. They say this maximizes char and crunch. So that's what I do. I take a pound of DiCecco spaghetti, same brand Giotto told me they use, and I add a jar of sauce. Because remember, I favor using good jarred tomato sauce over making it from scratch. But as soon as I start cooking, I run into problems.
Didn't seem like enough liquid. I added half a jar of water. Then the tomato sauce was still mostly evaporated, but the pasta was hard in the center, so I added another half a jar of sauce and a little more water. I just want to figure out how much liquid I need, and then I can figure out the ratio of sauce to water.
All I'm really basing this first attempt on is having seen Asasina cooked once in Bari, and knowing how I want the end result to taste. I quickly realize I should have gotten a little more info.
It's all sticking to the bottom. It's really burning. I might be ruining this pan. This might be this pan's first and last attempt at spaghetti alla Asasina. The sauce has completely cooked off and burnt. The pan is black, and there are pieces of pasta that have broken off and fused to the bottom of the pan. Basically, I ended up turning the pan crispy without turning the pasta crispy.
I'm not using a nonstick pan because I don't remember the chefs in Bari using nonstick for their Asasina. But whatever they did to prevent sticking seems to have eluded me. My daughter's come into the kitchen to see what's going on.
Becky, how would you describe how this looks?
This kind of looks like a cry for help.
Despite the smoky haze in the kitchen and the pan looking like it was pulled out of some kind of wreckage, the pasta itself looks like it might not be terrible.
Emily thinks it looks good.
It looks yummy, but it doesn't look like what it's supposed to look like. It looks like you just tried and failed at life.
As I continue cooking the pasta, Janie walks in.
It smells good and looks good. Did you destroy the pan?
Maybe. I wonder if I transfer this to a nonstick pan with oil if it might crisp. Let me give that a shot.
No, don't ruin another pan.
Despite Janie's protests, I make the transfer.
I hear some sizzle. That's promising.
I try not to fuss with it too much, to let it sit and get crispy. And that seems to work.
We have some charring.
I decide this is as close as I'll get for a first attempt, and I begin putting the pasta on plates to serve.
Emily, what do you think?
I think that it's really good.
What do you notice about it that's different from other pasta dishes you've had?
It's crunchy.
Yes. Becky, thoughts?
Bruh, it's so good. It looked so bad when it was in the pan and ended up being good.
It's like like a bibimbapple, you know, like it's crunchy on the sides.
Mm-hmm.
I think it needs a little more sauce, maybe.
Yeah, I think you're right, Janie.
It's a little dry
and a little too brittle. I would want it to be a little more chewy.
I think the chewiness is perfect, but I think it needs a little bit more spice. It doesn't taste that spicy.
I really like it. So the only thing you have to do is buy a pan that you're ready to throw out?
No, you gotta use a nonstick pan.
Janie and I start to clean up.
And here you are now picking the dried, crusty pieces of burnt pasta off of the destroyed pan.
Yeah.
That's a good sign to me. I'll take that as a compliment.
Yeah.
I think it was pretty good for a first attempt. I thought it was going to be horrible. I didn't think you knew what you were doing.
And so what did you learn from this experience?
That's nice.
Maybe I should
Come on, you can say it.
I'm going to go have more pasta.
I think she was going to say that I actually know how to do things.
Yeah, I can do things. But if I'm going to get this Asasina recipe right for my cookbook, I'm going to have to do everything better. I spend some time reading through the few recipes online for spaghetti all'Asasina to see how others do it. I think about what aspects of my version need improvement. Over the next couple months, I work to get it dialed in.
Spaghetti all'Asasina, take two. I managed to not nearly destroy a pan. Just went nonstick the whole time. So that was an improvement. Emily, thoughts?
Last time, I think was maybe a bit more crunchy.
In some ways, this actually feels like a setback because it's a lot less crunchy.
Do you think that the brand of sauce makes a difference? The amount of sauce?
The amount of sauce will make a difference. And
less sauce would make it burn better, right?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. There's two different factors. There's sort of there's the burning of the pasta, and then there's the caramelization burning of the sauce. And I think what happened was I confused the burning of the char of the tomato sauce cooking down and turning dark. All right, I was falling asleep too. I managed to put all three of my family members asleep by talking about
sweet. Just keep making the food. We don't really need to know the details.
Another issue with all my tests so far is that the raw pasta is not getting fully submerged in sauce. My pan isn't big enough to lay that much spaghetti flat, so I have to toss the pasta to coat it in sauce so it can soften. But in mixing the raw pasta, I keep breaking a lot of it, leaving it in shards. I decide that on my next trial, I am going to boil the spaghetti for a minute or two first, rather than starting with it raw. If it's a little soft, it'll be flexible enough to lay flat in the pan and be submerged in sauce without having to be tossed so much. At the place in Bari where they make my favorite assassina, they insisted that you shouldn't boil the pasta first, that it would make the final result mushy. But they must be using a very big restaurant-sized pan that allows them to lay all that raw pasta flat. I don't have that option, and I want my recipe to be practical for home cooks. So I give the pre-boiling technique a shot.
All right, spaghetti all'assassina take 3 is underway. The kids aren't around. I boiled it in water for 2 minutes and then put it in the sauce.
Sizzling sounds.
All right, the sizzle has turned into a crackle.
I finish making the assassina and serve it up to Janie.
I think this is my best attempt yet.
Yeah, this is really good. And the strands stayed together.
I think I nailed the texture.
The thing that's different to me, this I felt like last time it was a little more sauce.
Yeah, I did use more sauce last time. The tomato, the intense tomato flavor is missing a little bit. I got to get that back. This is spaghetti all'assassina take 4. This is the first time that I added tomato paste into the sauce. I think that was a big improvement.
How come some are like really crunchy and dark and some are really light and they're like normal? Like they're like complete opposites.
That's part of spaghetti all'assassina. I don't want every strand to be exactly the same. It's better if there's a mixture.
I've managed to get that char and that tomato flavor, but I'm still tinkering with the spice. Even the fancy crushed red pepper that I bought online for this doesn't seem to replicate the more complex spice of the assassina at Giotto. So for this last test, I had the idea to switch to chopped peperoncino, jarred hot peppers from the supermarket, and that's a big improvement. More important, after another test using partially boiled spaghetti, I think that's the way to go for my recipe. At home, with a normal person-sized pan, I think a brief boil makes it more practical. And frankly, I think the results can be just as good as if you put raw pasta in the pan. So maybe that's one more Italian food myth busted. At this point, I feel like I'm closing in on the assassina of my dreams. I decide to send the recipe to Captain Rebecca, our recipe editor, to have her test it out and share feedback. She loves it overall, but she does make some tweaks, which means I need to test it one more time. So in December 2022, 5 months after I first laid teeth on spaghetti all'assassina in Bari.
You hear that sizzle? That's the sound of our last trial for spaghetti all'assassina. What do you girls say? Do you deem this?
It is good.
Do you deem this recipe finished? Is it good enough to go in the cookbook?
Yeah.
All right, I was kind of going, hoping for like a sort of big triumphant moment here.
Okay.
You want to like be excited or something?
Hmm. Okay.
Maybe Becky was right to deny me my big triumphant moment, because the truth is, I think this last batch needs more tomato paste. I add one more tablespoon to the recipe and send it ahead to Captain Rebecca for a final test. The next week, she confirms it's good to go. Insert big triumphant moment here. So spaghetti all'assassina is done, but there are still a lot of recipes to finalize, which means a lot more decisions. And one of the biggest of all is what pasta shapes to pair with which sauces. Yes, cascatelli and my other shapes, Vesuvio and quattrocini, will get starring roles in the book, but I want to feature a wide range of shapes. So what makes a great pairing of pasta sauce and shape? This is a question I contemplate during multiple vision quests, by which I mean long walks with our dog Sasha. So prepare yourself, because this is going to take a minute. In order to pair a sauce with a shape, you first have to understand the different types of sauces that are out there. Once you know the type of sauce you're working with, you can figure out the best shape to pair it with. And I've come to the conclusion that you can classify all pasta sauces based on 2 criteria. You ready? Number 1.
Viscosity.
This is a fancy word for thickness and stickiness. A higher viscosity sauce is thicker and stickier, like mac and cheese. Lower viscosity is more thin and oily, like a white clam sauce. And number 2?
Chunk factor.
This is a combination of how many chunks there are in the sauce and how big they are. So a high chunk factor sauce could be shrimp scampi with whole shrimp or primavera with cubes of vegetables. Low chunk factor means chunks are very small, like in a ground meat sauce, or non-existent, like with vodka sauce. I've decided that every pasta sauce can be classified by its combination of viscosity and chunk factor. This framework really helps me make decisions about sauce and shape pairings. One example, it leads me to use shells in more recipes than I would have guessed. Because when you have a low viscosity sauce with a high chunk factor, there's not a lot of stickiness and thickness to bind the chunks to the pasta. Shells cradle those chunks beautifully, especially if you eat the dish with a spoon. In the book, I'll go into more detail on this concept and use these terms to explain why I've paired certain shapes with certain sauces. And I hope that this section of the book will help people match pastas with sauces even beyond the recipes in there, just as general pasta life advice. While I was off on my vision quest, my recipe developers were still sending me recipes that I need to test, so I get back at it. There's a vegan dirty orzo, a play on dirty rice, developed by the soul food sauce boss, Darnell Reed.
I love this. This is actually one of my favorite things so far.
I love it too, but I decided I wanted to have a little more Creole seasoning. Next is shells with miso butter and scallions from saucy spicestress Asha Lupi.
Holy shnikers!
What kind of cheese is it?
It's Parmesan cheese.
Yes, sir.
But it's got miso.
I decided to reduce the amount of butter, but that one's a hit, a clear winner. Super Nona Katie, Captain Rebecca, and I also take turns refining the cavatelli with artichokes and preserved lemon you heard us working on in episode 1. 8 months and 31 cans of artichokes after I found the recipe that inspired the dish, I do one final test, and it's perfect. Other recipes need bigger changes, like the Mexican wedding soup, a play on Italian wedding soup with turkey meatballs and chilies.
These meatballs are a little bouncy.
Bouncy?
They're not like soft and...
The meatballs are bouncy.
Sorry, I know you put a lot of work into them, but it tastes like cafeteria meatballs.
Ouch. I love the flavors, but I do hear what Janie's saying. I think trying to get all the spices evenly mixed into the meatballs meant I had to overwork the meat, and that made it a little tough. To reduce the need to handle the meat, I suggest to Captain Rebecca that we combine the spices first, then sprinkle that mixture into the ground meat. She tests out the new instructions, loves how the meatballs come out, and moves that one to the folder of finished recipes. Realizing that I was able to solve a culinary problem on my own makes me feel great. And even though that one was a lot of work, when I end up with a result that I love, it feels worth it. But when I don't get that result, all the old questions and doubts start to creep back in. Like with one recipe I asked my mom to test.
This was like, it just didn't work. It's too much. And also, the color is just not good. It looks like dirt.
That recipe doesn't make it into the book. Then there's a cooking catastrophe that brings Emily running into the kitchen. I ask her to do an impression of what I sounded like from the other room.
Oh, no! Ah! They come and there's like sauce.
I literally have pureed cauliflower sauce in all the cracks of my laptop. The number one thing I'm concerned about, scraping up all the sauce and getting it back into the bowl, because I can't bear the thought of having to start this recipe from the beginning again.
Coming up, weeks away from my deadline, another recipe failure sends me spiraling. And I get to a point I never thought I'd get to. Stick around.
Ooh, advertisements. Yummy.
Whether you're a family vacation traveler, a business tripper, or a long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. They've got over 7,000 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels. And you will get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. I especially love those Cambria Hotels. They have locally inspired hotel bars with all kinds of specialty cocktails, downtown locations right in the center of all the action. Radisson Hotels have flexible workspaces. That way, if you're a business traveler, you'll be able to get all your work done. On-site restaurants, fantastic. And then at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles and great pools for the whole family and spacious rooms. I mean, if you have kids, you understand the importance of the pool. If you stay at a hotel with a pool, almost nothing else matters. Fortunately, all the Choice Hotels take care of all the other stuff too, but I mean, a pool is a great start. Whatever kind of vacation you're going on, whatever kind of travel you're doing, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com. Where travels come true. A few years back, my friend Justin Warner from Food Network moved out to South Dakota. He opened a ramen joint, and he is always posting pictures of all the great food he's not only cooking, but eating all over South Dakota. He's always telling me to come visit. And you know, one of the best ways to experience a new place is to eat your way through it. But it's equally important to live your way through it, too. And when you summer in South Dakota, you can fill up on all the lake days, hikes, rides, and small-town strolls that'll leave you with a regained sense of wonder and a hunger to do it all over again. See why there's so much South Dakota, so little time at TravelSouthDakota.com. At Boar's Head, delicious is in the details. And you see that in their incredible selection of hummus flavors. Boar's Head hummus is expertly crafted to achieve the perfect balance of creamy texture and refined taste. You can taste those chickpeas. You can taste the tahini. You can taste a little bit of acidity. It's got it all. I especially love their roasted red pepper hummus made with fire-roasted peppers. You can even taste a little bit of that char. It's perfectly dippable. It's perfectly spreadable. This is the kind of thing you always want to have on hand in your refrigerator. Dip, scoop, spread, or smear Boar's Head hummus to your heart's content. Hummus so extraordinary, it can only be Boar's Head. Compromise elsewhere. Famous Amos chocolate chip cookies are so iconic that I just say Famous Amos and it's like I can taste it. Each cookie is filled with semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch. And the word satisfying is very key there because some cookies are crunchy and brittle, and I don't like that. But Famous Amos has a deep, tooth-sinkable, satisfying crunch that I know and love. And Famous Amos classic bite-sized chocolate chip cookies are bringing back the original recipe that everyone knows and loves. One perfect bite, everything classic in a cookie. Find Famous Amos cookies anywhere you buy your favorite snacks. Welcome back to The Sporkful. I'm Dan Pashman. Before we get back to the show, I want to let you know that I'm doing a bunch of exciting book events coming up, starting with a free virtual event this Friday, March 15th. I'll be on Talk Shop Live in conversation with my friend Kenji Lopez-Alt, who was nice enough to write the foreword to my book. I'll also be taking questions from you. And you can actually order signed copies of my book through that event page right now. There's a link at sporkful.com/tour. Again, the virtual event is this Friday, March 15th at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific. And after that, I'm hitting the road for a series of live Sporkful tapings that will also be book signings. I'm going to be in conversation with more incredible folks than I can list here, hitting cities all across America. It's the biggest tour in Sporkful history. So I hope you'll come out. I'd love to see you there. You can find info on the virtual event and all the live shows at sporkful.com/tour. Now, back to Anything's Possible. As the fall of 2022 turns to winter, my deadline is approaching. In the midst of hosting this podcast, doing Cascatelli stuff, and helping to shuttle the kids here and there, I finished about 75% of the recipes, but it feels like I'm limping towards the finish line. Decision fatigue is setting in. And that's not the only kind of fatigue I'm battling. Driving back from another trip to the grocery store, made pasta with potatoes and cheese for lunch, play on a classic Neapolitan dish. Now I'm cooking swordfish with salsa verde pasta dish for dinner, which also sounds delicious, but maybe the potatoes and cheese are just still in my belly, but I gotta be honest. I think I'm getting tired of eating pasta. The two pasta recipes in the same day is a lot. It's kind of grueling. It's hard. I have to, like, mentally, like, put myself in an altered state where I'm tasting them and, like, imagine if you were really in the mood for this. Then would you like it? The recipes on my to-do list start to run together in my mind. Which one were we adding lemon zest to? Did I need to test that one with all the anchovies again? Now it's Christmas 2022, and I have 6 weeks to finish all my recipes. I test a baked cauliflower mac and beer cheese with a heavy dose of mustard and a pretzel crumb topping, inspired by one of my favorite bar snacks, a soft pretzel with extra mustard. I bring the finished dish when we go to a friend's holiday party. Janie and I discuss when we get home.
I'm just feeling very demoralized. I spent like nearly 2 hours on that pasta dish tonight. That beer, cheese, pretzel, cauliflower, it's just like, didn't, I don't know, I didn't think it was that good.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I didn't try it, but everyone else thought it was good.
I mean, you know, it's mac and cheese, it can't be bad, but like, the sauce is very runny and it didn't really have the mustard flavor I wanted and the roux kind of was like, grainy, I don't know.
I think you're just really tired. Maybe you can think about it in the morning. Because, I don't know, everyone who tried it said it was good.
I mean, what are they going to say? No, it's just discouraging. I'm trying to check these things off my list. When I finish a recipe and feel like it's good, at least I feel like I'm making progress. And then to, like, put so much work into making one and then have it not come out well, it's just like, feels like I accomplished nothing.
I don't know. I'm tired and I'm over the cookbook.
When I was a kid, even before I knew exactly what I wanted to do with my life, I knew I wanted my job to involve being creative. I remember in Mrs. McDonald's fifth grade class, I had an idea for some kind of science activity center we could build, all about light and sound. I came home from school and spent the whole afternoon writing up an outline of the concept. Mind you, this was not for any assignment. I wasn't required to do it. I just got excited about the idea. This would happen to me periodically throughout middle school and high school. A creative spark led to an obsession. Whatever I would do when I grew up, I knew I wanted to keep chasing that spark. Now, 25 years into my career, I've learned that the harder part is turning an exciting idea into a finished thing that's actually good, especially as your ideas become more ambitious. Along the way, you're going to get discouraged, and it's going to feel like a slog, and you're going to question whether it's worth it. And for me, at those moments, I try to tap back into the spark that got me excited about the project in the first place. Now, as I hit a wall on my cookbook, I'm struggling to find that spark. Until one day, when I'm in the car running errands. I got excited because I got an idea. So, Ali Slagle, she has this cookbook called I Dream of Dinner, and I was looking through it. It's a great cookbook. And she's got this dish where she cooks pasta. She boils the pasta. Then she puts it on a sheet pan with some sauce and puts it in the oven so the whole thing gets, like, crispy edges. And I thought, that's genius. She uses a short pasta shape. I forget which one. And I was thinking about this. I was like, what if we used a long pasta shape? What if we took fettuccine, cooked it, boiled it, all right? Then drizzle it with some olive oil and put it on a sheet pan. Probably oil the sheet pan too. And you spread the fettuccine all out on the sheet pan so it's flat. It looks almost like a nest, like a flat nest. And because then it would kind of all, like you would end up with a cohesive bottom layer that would hold together and you'd actually like slice squares out from the sheet pan. And then I'm like, wait a second, this is basically a pizza. But instead of a crust of pizza, it's crispy cooked pasta. You could just do cheese and tomato sauce out of a jar on top of this crispy pasta base. And I just think this is a good idea. This is gonna be really delicious and different. I can't wait to try it. A few days later, I give pasta pizza a go. I take cooked fettuccine and put it on an oiled sheet pan. I top half with tomato sauce and cheese and half with artichokes, feta, and za'atar, which is a combo I use on homemade pizza sometimes. I put it in the oven. Becky and Emily wander into the kitchen while it's baking.
It smells like pizza.
This is an experiment. I'm not following a recipe that anyone gave me. This is just an idea that I had while I was driving.
Pasta pizza?
Yes. Should I explain it more, or is that it?
I mean, first of all, it's really all that I need to know. And if I ask you to explain it, I know it's going to go into like a whole hour speech about it. So I'm just going to avoid that and just say yeah and no.
You're basing this whole thing off an idea that came to you in the car?
Yes.
So you had no proof that it was going to work or not, but you still wasted materials on it anyway?
It's not a waste if you learn something from it.
No, it's still a waste.
I'm not worried about waste. It's cooked pasta. In my house, it'll get eaten. What I'm worried about is that I desperately want to see some proof of concept here. I really need some good news. For my first test, even if it's not perfect, I want some indication that it's even possible to cook pasta in a way that it coheres into a single sheet, firm and crispy on the bottom, so you can cut slices, pick them up, and eat them with your hands like pizza. But after 20 minutes in the oven, the pasta still isn't crisping on the bottom. The family is getting restless.
Pasta pizza would be like pasta on top of the pizza.
No, it should be pizza pasta because like the pizza is like describing the pasta. You're using pizza as an
adjective.
Exactly,
but if it was pasta pizza, it would sound like pasta on top of pizza.
That's what they're saying.
It's a pizza made of pasta.
Yeah.
So the adjective goes first. So pasta is the adjective modifying pizza.
No, pizza is the adjective. He's describing the pasta because the pasta is pizza.
Pizza pasta might technically be more correct. But to me, what'll make this dish special is that it functions like a pizza. It's topped like a pizza and eaten with your hands like a pizza. So if I call it pizza pasta, it sounds like a pasta dish. But I want it to sound like a pizza. So I'm overruling my family. Pasta pizza it is. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Because it won't matter what I call it if it turns out to be physically impossible. After another 15 minutes in the oven, I take it out.
Oh, we do have some crispiness on the bottom. I'm still not sure that it's going to really hold together like a slice of pizza.
I serve it to my taste testers.
So I had the artichoke and feta one first, and that wasn't really holding together, so I ate it with a fork. But right now I'm eating the tomato sauce and cheese one, and that seems to be holding together a lot better.
The fact that even some of the pasta pizza is functioning as I want is a ray of hope. I make note of what I need to change next time. More oil to make it crispier and figuring out how to make it stay together so I can cut and serve it without it falling apart. Over the next couple of weeks, I test the recipe again and again.
This is pasta pizza take two. The big change that I made is that I mixed egg in with the pasta, and that helps to bind it together to hold it together more. And I put more oil in the pan, which helps it to get crispier on the bottom.
It's definitely a big improvement from last time. It's like I'm eating pizza, but with pasta. It's really good.
All right, pasta pizza, take three.
This looks amazing.
It really looks like pizza, don't you think?
Yeah, but it's just so pretty looking. It's like it'd be nice to put out for a party.
I could eat this three meals a day, 24/7. It's literal gas.
Is that a good thing? Is that what the kids say?
Yeah, gas makes the car go, which makes friction on the road, which makes heat, which means fire, which is a good thing.
Got it. All right. We're getting closer.
Oh, this is as close as you need to get.
No, there's more room for improvement.
I continue to experiment with different quantities of oil, cooking times, and other variables.
All right. This is pasta pizza, take five. I mean, it looks amazing. It's holding together well. It's crusty. It's crunchy. The big change that I made this time is that I put the pasta in the pan in the oven by itself for 15 minutes before I put the toppings on to give it more time to brown and turn crispy. Emily, do you feel like it's gotten better?
Yeah, the other ones were more like pasta. This one is like tastes just like pizza.
Oh my God, yes. This is a lot better.
As I tell Janie and the kids, another change I made here is that I switched from fresh mozzarella to shredded mozzarella. Now, I love fresh mozzarella, but the problem was it was releasing a lot of liquid, and that was making the bottom kind of soggy. Shredded mozzarella holds the whole thing together a lot better.
We use shredded mozzarella when we make regular pizza.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is, like, you always say, like, I'm not a trained chef. You know, you just like to, like, obsess about food. Mm-hmm. Like, this is something that the recipe testers would typically do, and, like, you're not... you know, like to think like, oh, if I change the cheese, then it will be less watery or whatever. That's an impressive thought that you had. I think you're crossing over into, you know, culinary territory, chefdom.
It's delicious. But to be honest, this is kind of bittersweet because it's like, now if you don't keep making new versions, I can't keep eating them. And I'm never going to eat it again.
I feel really excited about this. And can I tell you something? I know that this cookbook has been a lot of work for me, and that's created stress for everybody, and I'm sorry for that.
It's not stressful. You know what? Feel free to make 1,000 dishes. Just keep eating and eating them.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're the only one who's stressed out. The rest of us are enjoying this.
Not sure Mama agrees. But when I'm a little extra stressed out sometimes, that means sometimes you have to deal with a slightly cranky parent. Is it worth it?
Depends on the pasta.
But this is why you do things like this, take on a project like a cookbook. Because the feeling of like having an idea while you're driving in the car and getting excited about it and thinking about it and then trying it over and over again and making it better and better and refining it and then finally nailing it, like seeing that idea through to fruition, like that's the fun part of my job.
And just like that, the spark is back. In the weeks that follow, I finish up the last of the recipes on time. I work with recipe developer Asha Loopy, aka the Saucy Spicetress, to figure out where that cauliflower mac and beer cheese went wrong. Turns out I got confused by some of her instructions. So we rewrote those to make them clearer for people, made a few more tweaks, and the finished dish is off the charts. Mac and cheese with a hint of mustard and beer, with a topping of crumbled Ritz crackers and herbs. I mean, I can't even. Writing this book has made me a better cook, and it's nice of Janie to recognize that. But in some ways, that mac and cheese dish made me glad I'm not a chef. A chef probably would have understood Asha's instructions. But I'm making this book for home cooks, like me. So if I can make sure the recipes work for me, they should work for you. In other words, I've come to see that for my cookbook, being a home cook isn't a weakness. It's a strength. Coming up next week in the series finale of Anything's Possible, we have the recipes finalized, but now we need to bring them together into a book. which means we need a title.
You're not going to win a James Beard cookbook award with the title Put It On Pasta.
We also need photos and props to go in those photos, which will require a trip to the junkyard.
Man, I already have like two huge carts that are like 400 pounds full of tile, but I can't stop.
And we need to design the cover.
I hate it. I actually hate it. Oh my God.
Are you serious?
Like, I can't even tell what that is.
We have a million more decisions to make and a million more things that could go wrong. How many of them will go wrong? Find out in our finale, which drops next Monday, March 18th, the day before the book comes out. And hey, if you listened to me eat my way across Italy in the last episode and thought, I'd like to do that, I hope you heard me announce that I have teamed up with the folks at Culinary Backstreets to create a food tour of Italy, hitting many of the same spots you heard me hit with many of the same people. Sign up for this tour and you'll eat in Rome with Katie Parla, cook in Lecce with Silvestro Silvestori, and eat spaghetti alla sassina in Bari with me. Come eat pasta in Italy with me. It's all happening in November. Get the info at culinarybackstreets.com/sporkful. To see behind-the-scenes photos and videos of this whole journey, follow me on Instagram at TheSporkful. And if you want to see The Sporkful live and pick up a copy of the book that I will personally sign just for you, I am hitting the road, traveling all across the country in conversation with some incredible guests. Get info and tickets at sporkful.com/tour. Special thanks to Bill Nye, the Science Guy, and Helen Zaltzman of the Illusionist podcast. They were the voices you heard say viscosity and chunk factor. Did you spot them? Also, special thanks to all my recipe developers. If you want to learn more about them, we've been sharing their personal backstories in short segments in the podcast, which ran in February, so I hope you'll check those out if you haven't already. The Sporkful is produced by me, along with managing producer
Emma Morgenstern
and senior producer
Andres O'Hara.
Our editors on this series are
Tracy Samuelson
and
Nora Ritchie,
with editorial help from
Tamika Weatherspoon.
Our audio engineer is
Jared O'Connell.
Original theme music by
Andrea Christensdottir.
Additional music help from Black Label Music. The Sporkful is a production of Stitcher Studios. Our executive producers are Colin Anderson and Nora Ritchie. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And this is Charlotte in Cologne, Germany, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium-iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.